Welcome to the 290th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host for today, Patrick Winograd. In this edition, our topics are a review of my weekend predictions, a look back at rivalry week action in college football, a look back at week 13 in the NFL, a look back at the last week in college basketball, that was Feast Week. College sports were great this last weekend, and a look at the NBA, of course. But let's jump right in with a look back at my weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on social media. Starting in college football, I went 3-1. In the NFL, I also went 3-1. In the NBA, I went 4-0. And in college basketball, I went 3-1, which means that I went 13-3 for the second consecutive week. It brings my record to 1,203-751 overall, which is a 61.6 winning percentage. A very, very good record. Very happy about where that sits currently. And in college football, the only loss I took was that South Carolina, number 15 in the country, beat number 12 Clemson on the road, 17-14. Two things about that game. One, very, very close game. Definitely could have gone either way. So not disappointed in that pick at all. And also, I actually was asked by a friend if I should, if they should bet on South Carolina or on Clemson on the spread. And I actually said South Carolina. So I did think that if I was betting against the spread, which obviously I'm betting the overall winner in these games, but if I was going against the spread, I would have gotten that game right too, because I did think that South Carolina would at least be able to keep it close. I think the line in that game is 3 or 2.5, depending on the book. But I felt like if you give me an extra 3 points, I'm picking South Carolina all day long. But it was a true 50-50 for me if you're just putting it on straight winners. So I did pick Clemson. I got it wrong, but I had a gut feeling that South Carolina might pull it out, and they did. Although it's definitely a hard-fought win, and Clemson arguably probably deserved to win the game and kind of choked it away. But that's a different story. Then number 5 Notre Dame beat USC, 49-35. Number 3 Texas beat number 20 Texas A&M, 17-7. And number 18 Iowa State beat number 24 Kansas State, 29-21. I got all of those games correct, so very happy about that. And then in the NFL, I went 3-1, as I said. The Packers beat the Dolphins 30-17 on Thanksgiving. That game ended up being, you know, it looked like a long time ago that game was going to be terrible. But then, you know, both of these teams, they started playing better. So in the end, you had a better matchup than what was originally thought of. So I'm happy for that, that game was better than people would have expected originally, because it did look like for a while that this Thanksgiving slate was just going to be terrible teams. And the first two games were, because the Lions were way better than the Bears. But we'll get to those games later, because they were actually still interesting. But then the Eagles beat the Ravens 24-19. That's the game I got wrong. The Chargers beat the Falcons on the road 17-13. I got that right. And then the Bills beat the 49ers 35-10 on Sunday Night Football in the snow game. That I got right as well. Moving on to basketball predictions in the NBA, I went 4-0. Started with the Thunder, who beat the Lakers 101-93. The Magic beat the Nets 123-100. The Timberwolves beat the Clippers 93-92. Low scoring and really close game there. Fun one to watch. And then the Suns beat the Warriors 113-105. So good week there in the NBA. And then finally in college basketball, Feast Week action. Most of these games I think were actually on Thanksgiving itself. Maybe a few of them were on Friday, I guess. But number 3 Gonzaga beat number 14 Indiana 89-73. Number 18 Florida beat Wake Forest 75-58. Illinois beat number 19 Arkansas 90-77, most overrated team in the country, finally lost, so they're not going to be ranked anymore, which I'm happy about because they don't deserve it. Then number 23 Ole Miss beat BYU 96-85 in overtime. That was the only game I got wrong this week. And again, 13-3 overall, very, very happy with my predictions. But my predictions for next weekend will be posted, as always, on Thursday. Let's now turn our attention to college football with a look back at significant action from rivalry week. We will start with a few games from my weekend predictions. Iowa State beat Kansas State 29-21, as we talked about earlier. Iowa State, just strong performance throughout this game. They got started early with a turnover and then a score and a short field. Rocco Becht wasn't exactly effective in terms of the completion percentage numbers, if you go back and look at it. But overall, they were still getting some big plays through the air and then doing enough on the ground that they had just enough offense and their defense really stood up in this game. So Iowa State able to get the victory there. That means they advance to the conference championship game against Arizona State, who I'll very quickly say they beat Arizona 49-7, I believe, was the final score, but not going to talk about it because it wasn't a very close game. But yeah, Iowa State, Arizona State is the Big 12 championship. Probably a playoff spot on the line. I don't think that after tonight's rankings, the American champion could be higher rated than either of the Big 12 champions, even with a win, but you never know, especially with this committee. So I'll say it's not a guarantee, but probably will happen. Then you have number 15, South Carolina. You want to talk about playoff implications. I think this win should put them on the bubble for the playoff. I think they should be kind of the swing team of based on what happens in UNLV, Boise State, and Iowa State, Arizona State, and you know the rest of the conference championship games, Georgia, Texas as well, SMU, Clemson, all of those games. I think that they should be a team that has a chance to make the playoff. And I think, plain and simple, frankly, they're the only SEC team with three losses that I would advocate for. And I've said this consistently, at least for the last few weeks, just because they have gotten better as the season has gone on, which is something that a lot of other teams can't say. I think Lenora Sellers, you know, the way he played against Alabama when they played him, because a lot of people are trying to say that South Carolina shouldn't be in because of the head-to-head with Alabama and Ole Miss. If you look at the way that he played in that game, he is not playing like that anymore. He is much, much improved. This kid is a freshman. Well, he's a redshirt freshman, but he is a freshman. And in that game, he honestly didn't play amazingly. You know, overall, Robbie Ashford came in for a play because Lenora Sellers had a pretty rough start to that one. He ran for 1 yard per carry in that game. He threw an interception in this one, 23 of 38 for 238 yards and two touchdowns with one interception. So, you know, not great. He also lost two fumbles in this game, so he turned the ball over three times. If you look at his games since then, he has really, really limited the turnovers. It really isn't an issue anymore. I mean, he's definitely turned the ball over at times. Last three games, he has an interception in each game. But when you look at what else he's doing in those games, first of all, one of those games he threw for five touchdowns, 353 yards against Missouri. Another one of those games he threw for three touchdowns and 307 yards. And in both of those games, he rushed for 50-ish yards. And then in this game against Clemson, he rushed for 166 yards and scored two touchdowns on the ground, even if he didn't throw for one through the air. Had over 300 total yards, which is something that he's now done three games in a row, and almost did at Vanderbilt also, which was also a comfortable win for them. If you look at the comfortable, or the common opponents, excuse me, South Carolina since that game has just demolished teams that both Alabama and Ole Miss have struggled with at times this year. I mean, look no further than their very next game after Alabama. They went on the road at Oklahoma and won 35-9. Mind you, this same Oklahoma team beat Alabama 1 week ago. I'm just looking at a different team right now. This is not the team that was playing in week five. And I think that the committee has to see that. I don't know that they will, but I think they should. And also, they also beat Kentucky on the road. That same Kentucky team, as we know, beat Ole Miss. So, however you want to slice it, there are reasons to say that South Carolina deserves to be in there instead. They also picked up three ranked victories in that time since then, and a win at Vanderbilt, which the committee, I think, apparently is saying is a good win. Also, by the way, Vanderbilt beat Alabama, of course. So both of the two teams that Alabama lost to that are unranked, South Carolina handled them, like, easily. So I just think it's a much improved team from that point in the year. And I also think they shouldn't have lost the LSU game. They kind of got screwed over by a bad call in that game. And if you take that away, they are a 10-2 team. They're easily in the playoffs. So even if they had lost, even with the loss to Alabama and Ole Miss. And I think that the committee has sometimes ignored head-to-head. I think this might be a case where they should. And I believe that with the wins that South Carolina has gotten over the course of the season, with the fact that they've won six in a row, whereas Alabama has kind of limped into this, and so has Ole Miss, frankly, I think that there should be no other way to go other than to give them the spot if it's coming down to those teams. I don't think it should come down to those teams in the first place. I still think that SMU should make it with a loss, et cetera, et cetera. I've talked about this. I don't think three-loss SEC teams have a place in the playoff. But if they're going to give a spot to one of them, it needs to be South Carolina. And the other one I will say is, I guess technically Georgia, because if they lose the SEC championship game, they'll have three losses. But again, that's actually the one point that I do agree with what Lane Kiffin said, which was, if you don't play in the SEC championship game, you might get an advantage because you won't pick up an extra loss. But I don't think Georgia is going to get punished, and I don't think they should for playing the 13th game in the SEC championship and moving to 10-3 if they do lose that game. They could easily just win the game. But if they do, you know, I don't think they should get punished for it, because at the same time, you know, Alabama or Ole Miss, and I also think South Carolina would also lose to Texas. So if you want to play the hypothetical game, which the SEC loves to do, I think all three of those teams would lose that game. They'd have four losses if they had actually made the championship game. So Georgia shouldn't get punished just for getting there. I think they are probably safe, and I think they arguably should be. There may be a few teams that I would want to see above them, but I don't think is going to happen anyway, so it's not even worth talking about. But that's the end of the South Carolina deal. One of the teams that I would maybe like to see over a three-loss Georgia, but it's definitely not going to happen, is number six Miami. They lost to Syracuse, though, 42-38. They have no one to blame but themselves. Every single game this year that was super, super close, you had a feeling that they were going to lose two or three of those games at some point this year. They're lucky they only lost two. They could have lost the third to Virginia Tech way earlier in the season. But it came back to bite them that they just played everybody close that had really a pulse the entire year long. And again, came back to bite them this weekend. Syracuse, three losses. Speaking of the SEC, I even saw a quote from Brett Bielema on Twitter related to kind of Illinois' victories this year, talking about the fact that they had a better strength of schedule and they only lost to the number one and number four teams in the country, while also, and then a one possession loss to Minnesota, I believe, while picking up some quality wins along the way. Syracuse also has wins over Miami and UNLV, maybe not the strength of schedule that either of those teams, other teams had, and you know, some of the losses not so great, but you know, it's just food for thought in terms of this team's unranked, hasn't even been close to being ranked, it feels like, but the other SEC teams are still competing for a playoff spot, despite the fact that this weekend proved that there isn't much of a difference between the ACC and the SEC. I mean, Louisville hammered that Kentucky team that has beaten, that took Georgia to a one-point game this year and beat Ole Miss earlier. So there really isn't that much separation, despite the fact that people think there is. And obviously, South Carolina beating Clemson is a good result for them, but you know, Clemson, A, could have won that game very easily, and B, should have won that game. And also, it was still close. So, really, not much separation between the ACC and the SEC. If you ask me, below maybe the top teams when you're talking about the Texases and Georgias of the world. But speaking of Georgia, they almost lost this weekend to Georgia Tech. They went to eight overtimes and then won 44-42. My only thought about this game, well, two thoughts about this game. One, please bring back the old overtime rules. And two, please stop saying that the SEC is just so much better than every conference when they clearly demonstrate on the field that it's not every single week. And then going back to weekend predictions games, number five Notre Dame beat USC 49-35. This game is a lot closer than the final score indicated. USC actually was at the 20-yard line with a chance to tie the game with 3.5 minutes left. But instead of tying the game at 35, they threw a pick six, so Notre Dame went up by 14. And then they threw another one after that, so really skewed the final score a little bit, but they did have their chances, and then they came back in garbage time and scored a touchdown on their own. But yeah, USC had their chances. Notre Dame did what they do all year long. Their defense makes plays when it needs to, just like it did against Texas A&M on the road, which is exactly what Texas did this weekend. Texas A&M's offense did not score a point in this game. Texas only let A&M score because of a pick six. They were up 17-0 at the half. Complete shutout from the defense. Amazing game by the Longhorns defense. I would like to see Quinn Ewers in a little bit more of a rhythm in the SEC championship game. And if they can do that and he can play better, this is one of the better teams in the country, maybe the best team in the country. But for now, the best team in the country is going to remain Oregon, who beat Washington 49-21 this weekend. Very good result for them in their rivalry game. Speaking of rivalry games, but this one, not a very good result. Michigan went on the road and defeated number two Ohio State, 13-10. I say that with a little bit of a chuckle because, well, it is kind of funny that after all this time, it's been 5 years since Ryan Day said that he was going to hang 100 on Michigan in a game, but yet it's been five games since then, five editions of the game, And he has scored 86, their team, I should say, not him. He definitely hasn't scored any points. Has scored 86 total points or 87 total points. I don't really care if it's 86 or 87. He's still another full game short of getting to 100. And frankly, the way this rivalry is going, I don't know if they're getting 13 points next year. It's possible that, I mean, this is the best collection of talent Ohio State has had ever. This is the worst Michigan team that has been here at least in 6 or 7 years. And still, they couldn't even break 10 points in this game. So unless, I don't want to say unless serious changes are made in Columbus, but I mean, I don't know how you respond to this. You've lost now 4 in a row to Michigan. You had complete control of the rivalry the entire Urban Meyer era. He never lost to Michigan. The team that Ryan Day inherited that was all of Urban Meyer's players and his own freshmen, they beat Michigan. But ever since then, nothing. Just not even a chance at any of these games. So I don't know what you do from here if you're Ohio State. I guess the first step is to go into the college football playoff and try to win a few games there. Obviously, they still have the national championship right in front of them. Mind you, this team was favored to win the national championship heading into this game against Michigan. Definitely not the favorites anymore because, you know, you don't lose to a 6-5 team that struggled all year in the Big Ten and literally was 500 in the Big Ten going into the game, and then not see your odds to win the national championship dip. But at the same time, still a very formidable team. If they can shake off, you know, that game, I mean, this is a team that, as we know, took Oregon down to the wire, arguably could have won that game without some poor clock management and some smart clock management from Dan Lanning on the opposing side of that game. But at the same time, it's also a team that lost to a 6-5 team. You know, Indiana took care of Michigan pretty comfortably. Washington beat Michigan this year. Illinois beat Michigan by multiple possessions. So this is not a team that has, you know, Michigan is not a team that has had, you know, bad breaks that have caused them to lose games. They have been dominated by teams throughout the year. Not every game. But their losses aren't only 2-3 point losses. There are some 10-point losses in there. There's a 14-point loss to Illinois. There's a game where they led by 21 over Minnesota, and it ended up being a 3-point game. I can go back at many examples. This Michigan team had no business being in this game, and yet playing with house money, they were able to beat Ohio State. It's unacceptable for Ohio State to play like this year after year in this game. You just cannot do it. And then on the other side for Michigan, a 7-5 season, terrible, obviously not what you want to do after winning a national championship. But at the same time, there's a chance to completely salvage this season. The 50-6 win over Northwestern looked great for the eye test. Winning this game on the road is always going to salvage your season. Beating Michigan State and Ohio State in the same season will always be a successful season. If you win a bowl game on top of that, make it 8 wins, get Bryce Underwood, the 5-star quarterback, coming in, and maybe someone from the transfer portal as well to give kind of an immediate option, kind of a Dylan Gabriel, Dante Moore situation at Oregon, then all of a sudden you really have some momentum going into next year, and I can see this team easily bouncing back and making the 12-team playoff with a much easier schedule next year, because that schedule is a lot less of a gauntlet than it was this year. Then, moving on from that game, Memphis beat number 17 Tulane 34-24. That really crashed the hopes of Tulane making the playoff, as unfortunate as that is. They're still going to be in the American Conference Championship game, but they're playing away at Army now instead of at home in that game, and they also now don't really have much of a chance because they were sitting at 17 heading into the game, and now they have 3 losses, and they're probably maybe going to be unranked. I mean, I think there's a chance they stay ranked, but I think Memphis could take that spot as well, and Tulane would at least be somewhere in the 20s if they were ranked. Definitely not in the teens anymore. But that's it for college football. Long recap there. We'll move on now to the NFL with a recap of Week 13. Starting with some of the action on Thanksgiving, the Lions beat the Bears 23-20. This was Thursday, so it's been discussed too much at this point. I'm not even going to go into it, but Matt Eberflus made some very head-scratching decisions after the Bears almost mounted a comeback to win this game. They should have at least tied the game, or at least had the opportunity to kick the tying field goal, but terrible clock management led to the Bears not even having an opportunity to get the field goal off and still having a timeout that they took with them back on the flight home. And even though they took the timeout with them on the flight home, Matt Eberflus, well, he made the flight home but didn't make it through the press conference, basically like an hour or two after his press conference. After that game, he was fired. So the Bears will be moving on from Eberflus. He will be finding a new job, and the Bears will be finding a new man to lead the operation with Caleb Williams and a pretty promising future, a good collection of talent there. But just they've lost way too many one-possession games. They're attributing it to the coaching staff, which often is the case. When you lose a lot of close games, a lot of times the coaches get the blame. That's what happened here, and the Bears will be moving on. Then, keeping it in that same division, the Packers try to keep pace with the Lions and the Vikings. They won 30-17 against the Dolphins. Dolphins tried to make a comeback late in this game, but a 24-3 halftime lead was just too much for them to overcome. And, you know, Tua in the cold weather never delivers. At least that's been the narrative for a while, and it's going to continue to be the narrative until, you know, he goes on the road and wins a playoff game, beats really anybody in the regular season, whether it's the Bills or, you know, maybe even the Patriots in their division, but it's cold. I don't know, but he just hasn't been good in those kinds of situations, and Lambeau obviously was chilly on Thanksgiving Day, so not the best situation for him. He played better in the second half. Overall, their offense looks a lot better. They look like they could at least contend for a playoff spot, but I don't know what their schedule looks like coming up. They're going to have to win some games that arguably they shouldn't if they're going to actually make a run at the playoffs. Then you have the Buccaneers, who beat the Panthers 26-23 in overtime. The Bucs desperately needed this win. They have lost a ton of games that they just shouldn't lose, even though they've also gotten some wins that they shouldn't have gotten at the same time. But the Bucs, you can't lose to the last place team in your division. I will say, though, Bryce Young, he really has started to play like the guy who the Panthers drafted number one overall. He, at this point, I've seen comparisons, you know, the last four or five games that Bryce has actually started. He's playing better than C.J. Stroud is over his last four or five games. And, you know, that's always going to be the discussion. That's going to be the comparison point. The number one pick against the number two pick. Those were the options for the Panthers and also the Texans. And for a while, it looked like C.J. Stroud was by far the better pick and the better player. Now it's looking like the Panthers are a little bit more competent with Bryce Young. They let him sit behind Andy Dalton for some time, then they brought him back, and now he's played a lot better. They've looked better as a team. They could be 3-1 with him as a starter in their last four games had they won this game before overtime, but they didn't. Instead, it's the Bucs moving to 6-6, which moves them into a tie for first place in their division because the Chargers went on the road and beat the Falcons 17-13, as I said in weekend predictions. Pick six in this game by Tarheeb Still, was really the game changer here. Kirk Cousins has not played that well recently at all. He's been turning the ball over a ton and led to another loss this week for the Falcons, and now both of those teams sitting at 6-6, tied atop the division. They're also tied atop the division because the Saints, they fell 21-14 to the Rams. Completely shut down the Rams' offense in the first half. They were leading 6-0 at the half. I think they said it's the first time McVay has been shut out in the first. A McVay team has been shut out in the first half in like 120 games or something like that. It might not be 120, but it was at least a triple digit number. I couldn't actually see the number on my plane flight because it was a little too small for me to read and a little too blurry. But the Rams, regardless, they get the win. They move to 6-6. Very, very important in that division where all of those teams are kind of bunched up in that 6-6, 7-5 range. Speaking of that division, the Vikings beat the Cardinals 23-22. Last minute comeback here by the Vikings. A strong 2-minute drill run by Sam Darnold and Aaron Jones got the game-winning touchdown after making some mistakes earlier in the game that almost cost the Vikings the game. He fumbled the ball as he did last week. But then once again, he bounced back like he did last week. And then Kyler Murray threw an interception with Arizona having a minute to drive down the field and try to get a field goal to tie. They were not able to do that. So the Vikings escape with a 23-22 victory over the Cardinals, which means, of course, if you're looking at the NFC West, the Seahawks are in first at 7-5. Not going to talk about them because their game against the Jets wasn't that relevant, wasn't that close. But they're in first. Rams and Cardinals tied for second at 6-6. San Francisco at the bottom at 5-7 because they lost to the Bills 35-10 this weekend. Meanwhile, the Bills become the first team outside of the Chiefs, to clinch a playoff berth. The Chiefs clinched a playoff berth, but not their division, which is why I mixed that up for a second. But the Bills became the first team to clinch their division, one of the earliest teams ever to clinch a division. And as a result, we know the Bills will be in the playoffs. Just a strong, strong season from Buffalo, and their division obviously hasn't been too great, so it makes sense that they were able to clinch this early, whereas the Chiefs still have to contend with 2 8-win teams in their own division, which we'll talk about some of those teams in a second. But the Bills, credit to them for clinching the division. The Niners, things just keep getting worse. Christian McCaffrey now out for at least what looks like a while with another injury to his leg. Just not any good breaks for the Niners this season. They haven't gotten anything to go their way. It's just kind of been a tale of every single time it feels like they might be gaining some momentum, it just ends immediately because of another injury. And that story has continued throughout the season and continued again on Sunday. Then you have the Texans, who beat the Jaguars 23-20. Story of this game, though, not outside of the Texans continuing to play really bad teams close and not beating good teams, was that Trevor Lawrence got injured in this game on a hit by Azeez Al-Shaair. It was a big hit. It was, honestly, I don't want to call it a dirty hit. It was one of those where, you know, Trevor Lawrence slid relatively late. I really think Azeez Al-Shaair had a chance to react to it, but he didn't. It's one of those plays that does happen often in the NFL. It's kind of dangerous, and in the end, Azeez Al-Shaair got suspended 3 games for it. I think that's probably the right amount of games, and I'm not going to say that I would have suspended him more or less. I would have to look at past issues, A, relating to Al-Shaair himself, and B, related to other hits like this and what has happened in that fallout, but just not what you want to see at all. The hit gave Trevor Lawrence a concussion. He has had a really rough season in terms of injuries and also in terms of play on the field as well, so that continues for him. Meanwhile, the Texans on the field just have not looked like a playoff team. They probably will be because their second-place team in their division is the Colts, who are 6-7, but I just don't see this team playing quality football right now. But speaking of teams who are playing quality football, the Eagles went on the road and beat the Ravens 24-19. The Ravens had their fair share of opportunities in this game. Justin Tucker missed a field goal, I think a field goal and an extra point, maybe even more than that. Not quite sure off the top of my head. But fact of the matter is the Eagles did come away with the victory, and it felt like they deserved it. You know, Saquon Barkley was great in this game. Jalen Hurts did as much as he needed to do. It was really just a low possession game, low scoring game, 24-19, obviously. Lamar Jackson still had a great game, did not turn the ball over, but he threw for 2 touchdowns, 237 yards, 23 of 36 from in terms of completion percentage, ran for 79 yards as well. Pretty good game for him, but Derrick Henry only averaged 4.3 yards per carry, which, you know, for some NFL running backs, that's an okay number. For him, that's definitely an anomaly. It's an off night, no doubt about it. But, yeah, I mean, the Ravens really lost this game because they missed 2 field goals in the second half. That literally was the margin of defeat. If they had made those 2 field goals, probably would have won the game. But at the same time, they also turned it over on downs later in the half. And just overall, the Eagles deserve this win. And I think they played like the better team, and they have been the better team recently, even though I picked the Ravens to win this game. And then finally, on Monday Night Football, the Denver Broncos went on the road, beat the Browns 41-32 at home. This was one of the craziest games ever in terms of how bad but also great a quarterback can play at the same time. Jameis Winston almost threw 500 yards in this game, but also threw 2 pick-sixes and 3 picks in general, which, to be quite honest, that's about what you expect from Jameis Winston every week. It's just crazy that whenever you expect it, he kind of just delivers on it anyway. It just feels like he can't do anything more funny on the field until you see him the next week playing and he does something even funnier than he did last week. And he did it again. 497 passing yards again. 4 touchdowns, but also 2 pick-sixes that arguably might have cost Cleveland the game. But for Denver, they're playing well. They're at 8-5. It's looking like this is going to be a playoff team. I mean, the two teams behind them, yeah, the Dolphins are probably a better team on paper when fully healthy, but the Dolphins are 5-7, and the Broncos are 8-5. You can't argue with the record right now. Denver's going to have a bye week this week, and then they play the Colts, the Chargers, the Bengals, and the Chiefs. They probably only need I would think two wins there to clinch a playoff spot. Maybe one might be enough by the end of the season, depending on the other results. But also, it is worth noting that the Colts are 6-7. They are the team that's directly behind the Broncos. If the Broncos can get that victory, that would go a long way towards getting them into the playoffs, because the Colts don't play anybody for the rest of the year. They play the 3-9 Titans, the 2-10 Giants, and the 2-10 Jaguars. So if the Colts go on the road and beat Denver, they are going to be in prime position for a playoff spot, because like I said, Denver plays the Chargers, the Bengals, and the Chiefs. Even though the Bengals obviously haven't had a good season, they're still a talented team. And then the other two teams are fighting for a playoff spot and fighting for division control there, and are both 8-win teams at least. The Chiefs obviously at 11-1. So that's a really, really important game coming up in 2 weeks. Basically, we'll decide a playoff spot. And I think there's actually a chance that the Broncos could mathematically clinch a playoff spot by that time. But that is too far in the future for me to predict, with tiebreakers and everything. And that'll conclude our look at the NFL. Kind of a long look there. And college basketball doesn't get any less interesting, of course, because it was Feast Week this week. That means there were a ton of ranked games, and a ton of great games overall. And it doesn't stop with Feast Week, because this week is the Big East, Big 12 Challenge, the SEC-ACC Challenge, and the start of conference play in the Big Ten. So the little teaser that the Big Ten plays at the beginning of December. So there will be a ton of action to talk about next week. The net rankings just came out yesterday as well for the first time this season. People can study those and overjudge them all they want. They're not really going to matter until January, February. Anyway, once we actually have enough data, but 6 or 7 games in, I guess they're relevant for now, but you know that everything will change once there are bigger sample sizes, once teams have played more quality games, which are coming up. But speaking of quality games, let's start with Kansas, who beat Duke 75-72. That was the matchup of the number 1 and number 11 teams in the country. I think at this point, though, a lot of people don't think that Kansas is a number 1 anymore, and a lot of people don't think that Duke is as low as 11, but they keep losing, so you kind of can't argue with it for now. Then Colorado beat number 2 UConn 73-72. That was the first of 3 consecutive losses at the Maui Invitational for UConn. I'm realizing that based on time, I'm probably not going to be able to talk about every single game, so I'll just recap that UConn did indeed lose twice in that tournament. Dayton beat them for 7th place, and then they also lost earlier, and I'm forgetting who it was to. But I think it was another unranked team in that. Yeah, it was Memphis. Yeah, because they lost 2 unranked teams. But that was actually before, that was before the last podcast. That's why I already mentioned it. Number 4, Auburn, though, beat number 12, North Carolina, 85-72. This team is the best team in the country. I'm not even going to say anything else. I'm just going to move on. Number 5, Iowa State, beat Dayton, 89-84. Good bounce back after losing to Auburn. Again, Iowa State led Auburn by 17 points. So don't sleep on Iowa State at all. They are a very, very good team as well. They have another chance to prove it tomorrow against Marquette in the Big East Big 12 Challenge, which, or Big 12 Big East Battle, excuse me, my bad. But yeah, that's going to be a crazy game. Iowa State, a very good team. Then number 9, Alabama beat number 6, Houston. That game, a clash of 2 Titans at the Players Era Festival. Alabama comes out on top. Oregon beat number 20, Texas A&M, 80-70. That wouldn't be their only win over an SEC team this week. Stay tuned for that. San Diego State beat number 21 Creighton, 71-53. San Diego State has played a very interesting season, I think would be the best way to describe it. They're ranked 24th now, but they're 4-2. They're actually 3-2 according to how the NCAA actually looks at games, because they played a game against D2 Occidental College, and that doesn't count in the eyes of the NCAA. So if you look at this team, take out that Occidental game. They have played UC San Diego, who's one of the top mid-majors in the country, and then they've played Gonzaga, Creighton, Oregon, and Houston. So that is just a ridiculous slate of games. In those games, they're 4-2, which is a good, or 3-2, which is a good result, I would argue, coming out of those 3 games. But at the same time, still have 2 losses early. I have trouble ranking this team completely, I'll admit it. They played UC San Diego close, and then we're not sure how good Creighton is, because they just have played terrible this season. And then they lost, of course, at home to Gonzaga by a ton, and then Oregon beat them, and then they went to overtime with Houston, and beat Houston in overtime to claim 3rd place at the Players Era Festival, which I spoiled that, but now I won't have to talk about it later. But then, looking at other games, Michigan beat number 22 Xavier for a title at the Fort Myers tip-off. That Michigan team really starting to round into form. A lot of talent that's now starting to gel together. West Virginia beat number 3 Gonzaga, 86-78 in overtime, at the Battle for Atlantis. I cannot talk about every single game in the Battle for Atlantis, but West Virginia was, I think, the team that, in terms of my perception of them, went up the most, because the only power conference game they had on the season before this was a 22-point loss to Pitt. And all of a sudden, this team, instead of looking like, you know, a team that's just kind of down in the dumps, not really a great team at all, they beat number three Gonzaga, who looked like one of the most dominant teams in the country heading into the tournament. And now you're looking at a team that looks really impressive on paper, despite the fact that they didn't end up winning the battle for Atlantis, but they did pretty well. Then, for the Maui title, Auburn beat Memphis 90-76. Surprise, surprise, Auburn just dominated everybody the whole weekend. That's what they've been doing all season. Number five, Iowa State beat Colorado 99-71, just dominant from Iowa State. Number nine, Alabama beat Rutgers 95-90. Rutgers played everybody close, but they still haven't come up with a big win all year long. Their only win against a Power Conference team was against Notre Dame in overtime at the Players Era Festival, but that's not a good win. Notre Dame is the worst team in that field, and they still have the loss to Kennesaw State. So tournament odds-wise, Rutgers not looking too great, even though talent-wise they look amazing. But then Michigan State beat number 12 North Carolina 94-91 in overtime, a very big win for the Spartans. They needed to claim one of those big wins. They obviously played two unranked teams in their first two games, that being Colorado and Memphis. So not claiming any quality victories. If they couldn't get that third place win, but they did over North Carolina, now their resume looks pretty good. Then Louisville beat number 14 Indiana 89-61. Louisville looks great. Ended up losing in the title match of the Battle for Atlantis. I'll get to that later. But Texas A&M beat number 21 Creighton 77-73. Gonzaga beat Indiana. Talked about that in weekend predictions. Purdue beat NC State 71-61. Florida beat Wake Forest. Talked about that in predictions. Illinois beat Arkansas in predictions. Ole Miss beat BYU in predictions as well. Then in the title game of that event, number 13 Purdue beat number 23 Ole Miss 80-78. Really, really great game. Purdue is definitely one of the better teams in the country again. But Ole Miss, they really put up a fight in this one. I think had a strong showing despite the loss. I don't necessarily think that, you know, they might not be a top 25 team all year long. They might kind of fluctuate in and out, but I think they're safely at least in that top 30 range. And then number 18, Florida beat Wichita State 88-51 at the ESPN Events Invitational. They look crazy good this year. They just have not, no team has even played them close all year long. That includes playing at Florida State against Wake Forest on a neutral court, now Wichita State on the neutral court. They just have blown out everybody. And that's a scary sight, because the SEC doesn't need to get any better than it already is. Then, in the third-place game of the Battle for Atlantis, West Virginia beat number 24 Arizona 83-76 in overtime. Arizona has a losing record on the season. They're 3-4 on the season now as a result of this game, which is just crazy for a team that was in the top 10 preseason. Not saying they won't bounce back, but for now they're not a tournament team even. Not even in that picture at all. But then, in the Battle for Atlantis, Oklahoma beat Louisville for the title 69-64. Oklahoma played Providence and West Virginia on their road there. So two unranked games, but then all of these teams actually ended up being at least close to the rankings this week. And Oklahoma did get ranked because they are, I think, 7-0 in the season. Now they are undefeated. I just don't know if it's 7 or 8-0. Then in the Arizona tip-off title, Butler beat number 25 Mississippi State 87-77. Arguably looked like the third best team going into this tournament. With Northwestern looking a little bit better and Mississippi State obviously better. But Butler beat both of them. So that was a strong showing from the Bulldogs after that rough loss to Austin Peay to start the season. So Butler looking like they've kind of figured things out. That's now their only loss of the year. So I like how they are playing currently. Then Pitt beat Ohio State 91-90 in overtime. Zach Austin buzzer beater to sink the Buckeyes. Just a rough weekend to be an Ohio State fan. Losing in overtime in basketball at home. And then, of course, losing to Michigan in football, which obviously is, they don't care about basketball season just yet. But just a rough week for them. Then in the third place of the Players Era, San Diego State beat number six Houston 73-70 in overtime. San Diego State really needed this win because they don't have many other games left on their schedule that are great games. Cal is a good one for them, I guess. Not a good one, but it's a good enough game. That it'll get some respect if they win it. But the rest of their good games are going to come in conference. And that's not where you want to be if you only have kind of two big wins in the non-con, which that's what it would be if they had only beaten Creighton and then, you know, maybe would move on to hypothetically beat Cal. I think they will, but just hypothetically. If they hadn't, that would look really, really bad on their resume. They'd pretty much be locked out from being in as an at-large. But now, because they claim that win over Houston, which probably will hold up as one of the best wins all season, now it's looking really good for them. So San Diego State kind of split those four tough games. They went 2-2 against Gonzaga, Oregon, Creighton, and Houston. And I think by the end of the season, it'll bode pretty well for them. But speaking of Oregon, they won the Players' Era tournament. There were four ranked teams at this event. And Oregon, the unranked team from the Big Ten, they emerge as the champions. They now move, in my opinion, into the top 10 in the country. Some people don't have them that high. I think in the AP poll, they ended up 12th, I want to say. But they are a top 10 team right now. I actually don't think it's debatable. I don't know how they ended up only at 12. But they went 8-0. They are 8-0 to start the season. They beat Oregon State on the road. And then they also claim these three victories here. 8-0 with three quad one victories this early in the year is super, super impressive. But I'll move on from college basketball, and now talk about the NBA. The story has remained pretty much the same throughout the season. In the East, it's the Cavs and the Celtics at the top and everybody else behind them. The Celtics did lose to the Cavs this week. Not at full strength, obviously, so I don't know how much stock you want to put into that game. But Cleveland staying on top of the East with that victory. They're 7-3 in their last 10. The Celtics are 8-2 in their last 10. Only one game back of Cleveland. But a team that's closing the gap, it's the Orlando Magic. They have won six games in a row, 9-1 in their last 10. They're at 15-7 on the season. No Paolo Banchero, mind you, throughout this entire stretch. He played the first few games of the season, looked great. And then since then, the Magic, they know who they are. They're a defensive team, and they like the fact that they're a defensive team. They've adopted that mentality, and it's even better now with Paolo Banchero out. Paolo Banchero is a good defender, but not as good as some of the other options the Magic have. Of course, they're now more limited in scoring. Don't get me wrong. They are a better team with Paolo Banchero in the lineup, but they've now fully leaned in to that defensive kind of mentality, and I think that they'll be better for it by the time he comes back, because now you'll have a team that's really, really strong on defense. Guys are more comfortable with heightened scoring roles when they need to be, and you'll have an elite scorer coming back when he does come back, and that's a really, really dangerous combo. I think they're solidifying themselves as the third best team in the East. It's not just in the record, it's also in the eye test. Then the Knicks, they're at 12-8, having a good season of their own. They are currently in the fourth position, like I said, 7-3 in their last 10. But a team that's creeping up on them, it's the Milwaukee Bucks. They have finally put it together this season. They're 8-2 in their last 10, so they started off the season 2-7, but they're now sitting here at 10-9, fifth place in the East. It's the same thing I said about the Sixers last week, and I've been saying about the Bucks all season. The East is just so bad that you really only need a good week or two to climb all the way up the standings. And with how much talent is on that's on the Bucks and the Sixers, it doesn't necessarily take that much from either of those teams to just climb the standings in a week. That's what the Bucks have done this week with the six wins in a row. They're now they're still seven games back of the Cavs. They're not anywhere in the stratosphere of the Cavs or the Celtics, and frankly, not even the Magic for now. But they are now at the fifth seed. They're in a comfortable spot. They're above 500. And the team behind them, the Atlanta Hawks, they have won four in a row of their own. They went from 7-11 to 11-11, and now they have the sixth seed in their grasp in the East. Obviously, though, this is way too early in the season. I mean, we are a quarter of the way through the season, but seeding's not, it's too early to talk about seeding. Then you have the Heat at 9-10, eight games back. Indiana at 9-12, nine games back. Chicago, Detroit, and Brooklyn all at 9-13, 9.5 games back of first, and only two games behind that sixth place spot. And then Charlotte at 6-14, Toronto at 6-15, and then the Sixers, of course, at 4-14, just, they need to start playing better quick because now it is getting a little out of hand. But, of course, last place, the Wizards. Since they made that comment about not being that team that lost to the Pistons and then were that team that lost to the Pistons, they have been worse than the Pistons were last year. I mean, this team is awful. This is 14 losses in a row. They could rival the Pistons' losing streak, and it feels like they should, and it feels like they deserve it. This team just is not good. No other way to put it. But moving on to the West, where I'm not going to say this team is not good about any team, because they're all actually pretty good. OKC in first place, 15-5. They've been dealing with some injuries, but they're still playing well as a team. And then you have the surprises, of the West, Houston and Memphis. depending on who you ask, actually, either of those teams probably wouldn't be that surprising that they're high up in the West. But I don't think that many people had either of these teams at 2 or at 3. Obviously, the Memphis Grizzlies had their moments in the West a few years ago when they were fully healthy. Ja Morant had that team, you know, up in the top 2 or 3 of the West. They were I think they had the 2 seed in the playoffs when they lost to the Lakers. But at the same time, don't necessarily expect them to be there immediately this early in the season, kind of waiting for things to gel with the new look roster with Marcus Smart in the mix. And just honestly, with Ja Morant being out for so long, just getting him back into play and integrated with the rest of the team could have been a challenge, but it hasn't been a challenge. They've now won 6 in a row. They're 14-7, 1.5 games back of OKC for the best record in the West. Houston, of course, sitting at 15-6, a half game back. They have won 3 in a row, 8-2 in their last 10. Golden State, despite losing their last 4, they're still 2.5 back at 4th place, 12-7. Dallas, like I said last weekend, they were out on the outside looking in terms of the playoffs, but it only takes one good week, and we know what this team is capable of. They won 4 in a row. They're 8-2 in their last 10 now. They're 13-8, and they have the 5th seed in their grasp. Then you have the Clippers, who are 13-9, 3 games back. Phoenix is 11-8, just kind of treading water without Kevin Durant. When he comes back and is fully healthy and able to play full minutes, they'll be fine. The Lakers are sitting at 12-9, kind of doing what they've done all year long. They're not necessarily going to come out and dominate anybody. They're not going to come out and really just be flat out bad. But they have kind of their kryptonite in the Denver Nuggets, who are right behind them in the standings at 10-8. But other than that, they've played pretty well this year. They do need to figure out some more scoring off the bench, though. Some more reliable options that aren't AD and LeBron, which we'll see if they do find that by the end of the season. Speaking of Denver, like I said, right behind LA in the standings at 10-8. San Antonio technically tied with Denver. They're 11-9, which means they're both 4 games back of first place in the West. They've been playing pretty good, 7-3 in their last 10. And then two teams that are outside of the playoffs but definitely have the talent: Minnesota, Sacramento, 10-10 for Minnesota, 9-12 for Sacramento. Things have been rough for the Kings to start the season. For Minnesota, they still have a great defense, but offensively they've looked a little bit out of sync, and I think that would be my takeaway from them so far. Then you have two teams that maybe not as relevant. Portland, though, at 8-13, looking more competitive than I think I would have expected them to be. They shouldn't be in the same kind of record conversation as the Kings are, and yet they are. And then Utah at 4-16 is just probably going to end up in last place, to be honest. And then New Orleans without Zion Williamson, a lot of injuries going around for them. They've lost 9 in a row, 4-18 on the season. But that will conclude this NBA recap and this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, December 10th, where we will look back at my weekend predictions, review conference championship games in college football, look at week 14 in the NFL, and we will talk about basketball again with another weekly review of both the NBA and college basketball. In the meantime, be sure to check out my additional content, including our college football rankings, which are posted weekly throughout the season on Monday mornings. I think the last one might actually have been the last one of the season, though, because obviously not many games left to talk about anymore. And then my weekly college basketball bracket updates, which will be posted weekly on Wednesdays throughout the season. That includes tomorrow with the new update that will be heavily changed because of the net and feast week. And then, as always, my picks for next weekend's games, which will come out on Thursday. All that on social media at 4thand24 on Twitter and Instagram, and some of that content on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.